I'm Bob Doty reporting. The African Union says it will send human rights observers to Burundi, where fighting escalated Thursday after an attempted coup. Marta Vanderwolf reports from AU headquarters in Addis Ababa.
The worsening situation in Burundi led to the African Union Peace and Security Council holding an emergency meeting Thursday. Council Chairperson Ambassador Diallo Amina Djibo said several decisions were made.
The Peace and Security Council today had decided to quickly deploy the human rights observer in Burundi to help analyzing the situation and helping the civil population.
The African Union would not specify how many observers would be deployed or when. The coup attempt by former intelligence chief General Godefroid Niyombare happened while President Pierre Nkurunziza was in Tanzania. At least 14 protesters have been killed during clashes with police, and tens of thousands of Burundians have fled the country. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
U.S. President Barack Obama is meeting outside Washington with top officials from six Gulf nations. They're continuing a summit on Middle East issues, including a potential nuclear deal with Iran and the fighting in Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and Libya. The discussions Thursday are taking place at the Camp David Presidential Retreat, which is located just north of Washington. Speaking at the start of the summit Wednesday night at the White House, Mr. Obama spoke of what he called a very challenging time in the Gulf region. Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes told Al Hura that one of the goals of the summit is to examine military capabilities and ways for the Gulf countries to both work together with the United States. This is VOA News.
We're not looking at a binding treaty like we have with NATO countries, which is something that was painstakingly negotiated and developed over many years. But we are looking at a clear commitment from the United States that we will come to the defense of our GCC partners in the face of external threats. And we've shown in the past that includes potentially the use of military force, as we did in the Gulf War.
Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes. The Taliban claimed responsibility Thursday for an hours-long attack on a guest house in the Afghan capital that killed 14 civilians, including several foreigners. Kabul Police Chief Abdul Rahman said the attack began Wednesday night when gunmen began shooting at the Park Palace Hotel during a party for foreigners. 5 hours later, it ended with police killing three assailants. The U.S. Embassy said one American was among the dead. Another stranded boat packed with hundreds of migrants who are believed to be victims of human trafficking has been spotted off the coast of Thailand. The International Organization for Migration confirmed to VOA on Thursday the vessel was located, although it is not clear whether the boat is in Thai or Malaysian waters. Matthew Smith, the executive director of the Fortify Rights Group, tells VOA.
The whole situation is appalling start to finish. And it's an important point, I think, that it's been going on for quite some time. I mean, we know this certainly isn't the first time that boats have been pushed back to sea. This type of thing has been happening over the last several years. But the persecution of the Rohingya has been going on for several decades.
U.S. investigators are trying to determine why a passenger train was traveling at more than twice the posted speed limit before it crashed in Philadelphia. Attorney Robert Goggin said the engineer, 32-year-old Brandon Boston of New York, was not on his cell phone at the time of Tuesday's accident, nor was he using drugs or alcohol.
He remembers driving the train. He remembers going to that area generally. Has absolutely no recollection of the incident or anything unusual.
The National Transportation Safety Board said the Amtrak Northeast Regional train was barreling through a curve at 170 kilometers an hour. The posted speed limit is 80 kilometers an hour. Chinese President Xi Jinping has welcomed Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi to his family's ancestral hometown for a visit expected to help boost diplomatic and economic ties. The meeting Thursday in Xi'an, the capital of Shanxi province, is seen as a gesture of goodwill between the two Asian giants, who have been dealing with a long-standing border dispute. Official Chinese media reports have said that the two leaders are expected to sign $10 billion in economic deals during the visit. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Gunfire rang out across the capital of Burundi as rival factions of the military fought each other the day after a top general declared a coup. Much of the fighting centered around the state broadcaster.
That's VOA correspondent Gabe Joslow reporting from Bujumbura. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also in the news, suspected Boko Haram militants attacked the northern Nigerian city of Maiduguri, their first major assault on the Borno state capital in 2 months. A meningitis epidemic in Niger has infected well over 5,000 people and killed more than 350. And the WHO says the Ebola infection rate continues to drop in West Africa. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, gunfire rang out across the capital of Burundi today as rival military factions fought each other the day after a top general declared a coup. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports from Bujumbura that much of the fighting centered around the state broadcaster.
The shooting began overnight and intensified by daybreak Thursday as military factions loyal to the president battled dissident forces. Police maintained a heavy presence near the headquarters of the ruling party, the CNDD-FDD. A local resident who asked not to be named told VOA the situation is dangerous for civilians.
We tell them we go at work, but they shoot us directly without anything, without asking where are you going here. Just they shoot us.
Another resident, Ngugusoni Buyenzi, said he too was confronted by the police. The police are guarding the area, he said. Anyone who tries to cross over are told to go back. By afternoon, the streets of the capital were deserted. Soldiers in uniform were out guarding some of the key traffic circles and intersections in the city as gunfire could be heard from different directions. On a side street near the Interior Ministry, a soldier lay dead in the road. Soldiers told the Reuters news agency that he was a soldier from the pro-coup forces. Much of the fighting has centered around the state broadcaster that went off air briefly during the day after broadcasting a message from President Pierre Nkurunziza declaring he was still in control of the country. A pro-coup spokesman, Zeno Endebanezi, told VOA's Central Africa service the station is still in control of loyalist factions after dissident soldiers withdrew. Other private radio stations were also attacked and burned during the course of the day. Mr. Nkurunziza left the country on Wednesday to attend a regional summit in Tanzania to discuss the political crisis in Burundi. The attempted coup, announced by former Burundian intelligence chief Godefroy Niyombare, follows weeks of street demonstrations against the president's decision to run for a third term in office. Opponents say a third term would violate the constitution and a peace agreement that ended the country's 13-year civil war. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Bujumbura.
Thank you, Gabe. The AU says it will send human rights observers to Burundi, where fighting escalated today after an attempted coup. Marta van der Wolf reports from AU headquarters in Addis Ababa.
The worsening situation in Burundi led to the African Union Peace and Security Council holding an emergency meeting Thursday. Council Chairperson Ambassador Diallo Amina Djibo said several decisions were made.
The Peace and Security Council today had decided to quickly deploy the human rights observer in Burundi to help analyzing the situation and helping the civil population.
The African Union would not specify how many observers would be deployed or when. The general behind Wednesday's coup attempt had said the borders are closed. The African Union had dispatched a high-level delegation of the Panel of the Wise to Burundi last weekend in an attempt to find a peaceful solution to the country's political turmoil. The coup attempt by former intelligence chief General Godefroy Niyombare happened while President Pierre Nkurunziza was in Tanzania for an East African summit on the Burundi situation. The East African leaders said elections should be postponed until free and fair voting can take place, refugees can safely return, and all parties cease violence. But fighting has increased since the coup attempt, and it is not clear whether the president's supporters or opponents are in charge. Djibo says the Peace and Security Council is against any form of unconstitutional change.
The PSC strongly condemns any attempts seizing power through violence and attempt against peace. The PSC has also called to the Burundian stakeholders to cease fire as urgent as possible, to create the environment for dialogue, to peacefully resolve the crisis through peaceful and legal means.
The AU Peace and Security Council did not impose a deadline for when a peaceful environment has to be created or what actions will be taken if the situation gets worse. Protests erupted in Burundi last month when President Nkurunziza announced he would run for a third term. Critics say a third term would be unlawful, but the country's constitutional court ruled in favor of the president. At least 14 protesters have been killed during clashes with police, and tens of thousands of Burundians have fled the country. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Suspected Boko Haram militants have attacked the northern Nigerian city of Maiduguri, their first major assault on the Borno state capital in 2 months. Witnesses say hundreds of militants assaulted an area near the city's Giwa barracks late yesterday with guns and heavy explosives. There were also reports that several suicide bombers were among the attackers. Soldiers repelled the attack after several hours of fighting. The French news agency reports at least 3 Nigerian soldiers, 6 vigilante fighters, and dozens of Boko Haram fighters were killed. The army has imposed a dusk-to-dawn curfew on the city. Army spokesman Colonel Tanko Gusau said the curfew is intended to protect lives and property of innocent and law-abiding people of Maiduguri. Doctors Without Borders says a militia carried out a mass rape in DRC's South Kivu province earlier this month. It says about 60 men attacked the town of Kakamba on May 1st and looted homes, assaulted men, and raped a large number of women. The medical aid group says it treated nearly 130 victims of the attack. The militia also kidnapped about 30 children. Doctors Without Borders says about 100 women reported they had been sexually assaulted and that the victims ranged in age from 14 to 70. A meningitis epidemic in Niger has infected well over 5,000 people and killed more than 350. The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders warns there's no vaccine available for the particular strain of the rapidly spreading disease. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Meningitis inflames the membranes covering the brain and spinal cord. It can spread rapidly in overcrowded areas. Emmanuel Massar is field coordinator in Niger for Doctors Without Borders, also known by the French acronym MSF. He says the meningitis outbreak began a few weeks ago and has hit the capital especially hard.
We are really, really worried about the situation there in Niamey. We are concerned because the fact that the disease is spreading pretty quickly in Niamey.
The good news is treatment is available.
Basically, for the meningitis, we have one antibiotic, which is really, really effective. If you receive the patient soon enough, you give the proper treatment, and it should be okay.
However, Massar emphasizes that treatment must be given early.
One of the things we are seeing in Niamey is that the patients are arriving really, really late, and sometimes we don't even have the time to treat the patients, and we lose the patient pretty quickly.
The fatality rate can be as high as 50% if not treated. The outbreak now underway in Niger is caused by the C strain of the bacteria, which is not generally common in the region. In fact, much of the population of Niamey was vaccinated for the A strain in 2010. Massar says no vaccine is available now in Niger for the C strain.
One of the problems worldwide, there is a lack of vaccines. At the moment, it's not possible to buy any more vaccines. It doesn't exist at the moment. They are producing more, but at the moment, it's not available. It's one of the big, big concerns we have.
MSF is operating a 350-bed meningitis treatment center in Niamey. Niger is in what's known as the meningitis belt. It stretches across 18 sub-Saharan African countries that are home to about 300 million people. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up on 16 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The World Health Organization says the Ebola infection rate continues to drop in West Africa. 7 cases were reported in Guinea and only 2 in Sierra Leone. The total is the lowest in 5 months. Liberia was declared Ebola-free last Saturday. WHO Assistant Director General Dr. Marie Pauley Kini says there is no doubt the health emergency in West Africa is moving toward 0 new cases. However, she says the drop in infections will probably result in insufficient data on whether 2 Ebola vaccine trials are effective. Well, decisions are expected Monday about how Europe will cope with this summer's massive flood of migrants sailing from North Africa. EU foreign ministers are scheduled to meet in Brussels. They'll decide on a naval and air mission to seize the boats of smugglers off the Libyan coast. Also on Monday, the UN Security Council is expected to respond to a broader plan for dealing with more than 600,000 people from Africa and the Middle East expected on the southern shores of Europe this year. While the European Union wrestles with a new migration policy, many nations are pursuing conflicting social, economic, and racial paths regarding migrants. Leonard Doyle is with the International Office for Migration. He spoke to VOA's David Arnold about which countries want to open their gates and why.
There's a basic unwillingness in Europe to see itself as a space of immigration. Although it's been a country, or a continent rather, of migration for centuries, sending people abroad, not least to the United States, there's a reluctance to kind of basically see that they need migrants now. If the economy of Europe is to be competitive, they need people to work in the farms and fields and in the care homes and the hospitals.
What are the countries that are still so reluctant to take in migrants? And where are the xenophobes most popular on the continent of Europe?
You just have to look at the political map of Europe where the extreme right is doing well. It's happening in France. It's happening to some extent in the UK, although thanks to the electoral system, although they got 12% of the vote, they didn't really do very well. But it's happening in Northern Europe. It's happening in the places where you don't necessarily have the most migrants.
And so they're unfamiliar with the concept of integration of new cultures and new races.
I think they haven't really learned the American lesson of the melting pot or the salad bowl, depending on where you're coming from. And as somebody said at a press conference, they need to get over themselves.
What about Italy? It's had the primary role very successfully, at least in rescue and taking in migrants all over the country and in Sicily, but are they going to be successful in moving some of those populations to other countries?
Well, the Italians have been extraordinarily generous and played a huge humanitarian role in allowing people to come in. In fact, rescuing them, 24/7 with their relatively small coast guard. The people come in, they're given refuge, and they normally want to move on because employment for foreigners, if you will, is difficult in Italy. It's not the easiest thing. So the migrants themselves seem to kind of vote with their feet and get on the bus and get out of town.
So they're moving independently without control from the governments of the EU.
Exactly. They get ashore. They don't really like to be fingerprinted, and they don't have to be. And then they try and get themselves to Germany or France, and where they can get asylum status if possible. They prefer to have the first point of landing where they appeal for asylum to be somewhere in Northern Europe. The ones which are taking in migrants / refugees is Germany and Sweden. I mean, they are the ones who are doing it.
And that's a little bit surprising, given Germany's racial history.
Well, I mean, the Germans have a long history of, recognizing when people are in trouble. And they're proving it by taking in, a huge number of refugees relative to the rest of Europe. The evidence is that the Germans are the most generous in Europe, followed only by the Swedes, with a completely different history, of course. And, you know, it has its political cost, but they've shown over the years that if you are courageous and if you work with your society, if you have good information campaigns to explain that these migrants and refugees contribute greatly to the society, then it tends to work. It's when you leave it things to fester, you leave it to the xenophobes to take charge, and then things don't work.
The foreign policy head of the EU has said there are some actions they can take now.
Well, it's hard to know what they can do against the smugglers. I mean, if they're thinking of taking military action, how are you going to save the lives of the migrants at the same time? They're probably all on the same boat together. If you're going to sink a boat, how do you know you're not sinking a poor fisherman's boat? So, I mean, I think the kind of the good intentions that are undoubtedly behind this could end up creating a bit a bigger problem than they foresee.
Is the migration itself illegal?
Migration is never illegal. I mean, there's been people have been migrating since the dawn of time, and we encourage migration as a coping strategy for all sorts of things, including global warming, including economic dislocation, including structural unemployment. The problem is matching labor supply and demand, and if that's not done in a coordinated and managed way, you have the kind of chaos we see in the Mediterranean. You have images on the television driving people to the extremes in Northern Europe, and the same images broadcast in an African village are giving the impression that you can get to Europe without a passport. So this kind of lack of policy is creating chaos, is driving more irregular migration.
Could Europe sustain the increased populations from the migration?
Well, we think so. The 500 million people, more or less, in Europe. The number of migrants that landed last year is 270,000, thereabouts. You can see that if that's distributed around the continent, there's no problem at all.
Who are the migrants? I've heard Eritreans mentioned a lot recently.
Well, the migrants, about a third of them are refugees from Eritrea and Syria with proper, easily recognizable cases for asylum. The rest are undoubtedly, some have a case for asylum, but many of them are not, and they're from West Africa, usually French-speaking West Africa, or from Nigeria, for that matter. Many of them are, seeking to better their lives for economic reasons, and some have valid claims for asylum.
Do you think the EU measures are going to make a difference?
I think the difference is that they're finally focusing on it, and they've got their head out of the sand for the first time.
That's Leonard Doyle of the International Office for Migration. He spoke with VOA's David Arnold. Coming up on 23 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. An international agricultural coalition says poor soil health will drastically reduce the chances of achieving sustainable development goals if not urgently addressed. The group, Farming First, wants to educate farmers on how to improve their soil, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, where as much as 65% of the land is degraded. Representatives recently met in New York during Global Soil Week to address the issue and to highlight innovative programs working on the ground. Ian Chesterman is regional technical advisor of FinTract, a woman-owned U.S.-based consulting company that develops agricultural solutions to end hunger and poverty. FinTract supports the efforts of Farming First. Chesterman explained the importance of soil education for smallholder farmers.
Soil education and soil management is one of the fundamental skills that farmers need to take on board as a basic step to improving crop production and crop productivity.
You all have an initiative right now that is going on in Kenya termed Soil Doctor. Can you explain that and how successful is that program?
Soil Doctor is an initiative set up by one of our local partners called Crop Nutrition Laboratory Services. This is a partnership under the USAID-funded Kenya Horticulture Competitiveness Project, which was managed by FinTrack. And Crop Nutrition Laboratory Services is a private company that manages and provides a soil analysis service to farmers. And they specifically developed a service designed for smallholders called Soil Doctor. And they provided extension support in the rural areas in order to give feedback to farmers on the need for soil analysis, and they tailored a business package specifically designed to service the needs of rural smallholders in terms of soil analysis and fertilizer recommendations.
How successful is it?
In terms of the farm results, once farmers take the advice on correct fertilizer and also not just fertilizer, but one of the common areas that farmers have to address is to apply lime to their soil, because very often in many parts of Kenya, soil is too acidic for optimum crop growth. Once they've applied those recommendations, we've consistently seen farmers improve yields by anywhere between 40% to 150% within the first year, significantly improving their resulting crop income. So in terms of the impact both on their bottom line and also on their farming sustainability, it's very significant. In terms of scale, the partnership with the Soil Doctor Service provided by Crop Nutrition started in 2012, and it ran for just under 3 years. And initially, the level of soil sampling with smallholders was quite limited, less than 100 samples when we first started the partnership with the Soil Doctor Service. By the end of the partnership, as of this month, April 2015, I just checked on the latest numbers, they had reached just under 8,000 smallholder farmers with samples. So we've seen tremendous growth in the uptake of the service by farmers who have to pay for it. So they have to commit their own funding. That's been very encouraging to see this growth from less than 200 to 8,000 in the space of 3 years.
Looking at the future, what are the long-term prospects of these soil education programs and long-term prospects of reaching farmers in other countries?
The long-term prospects, we are encouraged. The basic principle of these partnerships provided through the project was targeting private sector companies who are providing a service to smallholders available in the rural area. So the Soil Doctor Service is still going on. In fact, it's continuing to grow, provided by the parent company. They want to see it reach a target of something like 5,000 samples per year, at which point they will start to see a recovery on their embedded investment. We also see that the benefits of the recommendations by farmers, they get those recommendations by text message and also by information provided in writing to their local agribusiness dealer in the next village or town. As word of mouth spreads on the yield benefits and on the long-term improvement to their farming prospects, we see an encouraging and accelerating trend in investment by farmers in soil analysis.
Ian Chesterman, Regional Technical Advisor of FinTract, he spoke with me from Nairobi, Kenya. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 28 minutes past the hour on the Voice of America.
On Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Explosions and gunfire have been reported in the capital of Burundi a day after a top general launched a coup attempt while the president was out of the country. And suspected Boko Haram militants attacked the northern Nigerian city of Maiduguri, their first major assault on the Borno state capital in 2 months. Coming up, we'll have music from South Africa and our feature reports. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Well, happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
And I understand you are kicking off with South African football.
Kim, the South African club Kaizer Chiefs recently captured its fourth Premier Soccer League title in record-breaking fashion. Our African football guru in Johannesburg, David Legg, joins us again this evening with more details.
The season is over. Every club has played its 30 matches, and I must say congratulations to the organizers. It wasn't that many years ago that it was rather haphazardly run, the South African Premiership. You had some clubs playing a lot of matches just to catch up, but a very efficiently run season. Kaizer Chiefs are the champions with 69 points, and they've broken two records, Sonny. 69 points is a record point total for a South African champion club. And also, they won 21 of their 13 matches, and that's also a record, beating the previous record of 20 set last year by Mamelodi Sundowns. Sundowns finished second, but well behind, Sonny, 12 points, in fact, adrift of Kaizer Chiefs. So Chiefs and Sundowns, they will play in the CAF Champions League next year. Wits, unfashionable Johannesburg club, they finished third with 52 points, so they will go into the CAF Confederation Cup. And unfortunately, Orlando Pirates, who generally are the most successful South African competitors in Africa, they will miss out because they finished fourth with 50 points. Fifth were Ajax Cape Town, sixth SuperSport United, Bloemfontein Celtic were seventh, and Maritzburg United were eighth. If we go down to the bottom, it was really a battle for some weeks now between AmaZulu, who play in Durban, and Morocco Swallows, who play in Soweto, to avoid automatic relegation. And on the very last day of the season, AmaZulu, needing a win to be sure of avoiding relegation, they lost 2-1 at home to Maritzburg United, so they're relegated. Morocco Swallows, they edged out Bloemfontein Celtic 1-0 with a goal from Siyabonga Nombeti, a well-known South African footballer, now 37 years of age, but as fit as any South African Premiership footballer. That's the good news, Sonny. They avoided automatic relegation. But the bad news is they must now go into playoffs with two second division clubs, namely Jomo Cosmos and Black Leopards. And only the winners of that double round mini league will play in the Premiership next season. AmaZulu, incidentally, will be replaced by another Durban club, Golden Arrows. They were the second division champions, and therefore they automatically qualify from the Premiership next year. Nigeria, Sonny, on the other hand, they're just 8 rounds into their season, and it's a big first division in Nigeria, no less than 20 clubs. And if we look at the top of the table, Sunshine Stars, they're shining, 16 points from 8 games, so they're out in front. Giwa FC, not a particularly big name, not a club that's ever played in Africa, for example, they've got 15 points. Gabros have got 14 points, and so have one of the names that I love among the Nigerian clubs, Wiki Tourists, 14 points. El Kanemi Warriors have got 13 points, as have the Abia Warriors. And then Kano Pillars, the defending champions, they've got 12 points from 8 games. And so have two other clubs that have been regular competitors in Africa for Nigeria, Heartland and Enyimba. Enyimba, of course, the only Nigerian club to win the CAF Champions League. They won it in 2003, and they successfully defended the title in 2004. If we go further down, Sonny, in 11th position, we've got Warri Wolves. And I mention Warri Wolves because they're the only Nigerian survivors at the CAF club competitions this season. Enyimba and Kano Pillars have already been eliminated from the CAF Champions League. And Wari Wolves, they carry the hopes of all of Nigeria in the CAF Confederation Cup. They'll be playing AC Leopards of Congo Brazzaville in the playoffs. And the winners of that tie will go into the group stage.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Hi, I'm Segun Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
And when you visit VOAnews.com, make sure you check out the Sunny Side of Sports blog, in which I write about a variety of sporty topics. My latest blog post is titled Atukwefio Praised as Pillar of Ghana Football, and I write about Cecil Jones Atukwefio, who died Tuesday of throat cancer at the age of 70. The Ghana Football Association remembers Atukwefio as a talented footballer, coach, and administrator who shaped the lives and careers of many Ghanaian footballers. One of them is the current Black Stars captain, Asamoah John, who hailed Atukwefio as a legend, a great coach, and an inspirational figure who gave him his first chance. John played under Atukwefio in 2003 with the Accra club Liberty Professionals. A couple of my friends in Nigeria read my blog post and responded positively. Our friend in Lagos, Segun Dot on the Spot Adeyemi, the VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, writes, "Hats off to you, Sonny, for giving Coach Atukwefio much-deserved recognition, even in death. Go well, Coach Atukwefio. You came, you saw, and you conquered. We will always remember." And Sir Joshua Zenit, writing from Port Harcourt, Nigeria, says simply, "A life well lived." Barcelona will play Juventus June 6th in Berlin in the UEFA Champions League football final. The Italian club Juventus shattered Real Madrid's dream of a record-extending 11th European crown on Wednesday. Juventus's Spanish striker Alvaro Morata, who was born in Madrid and he used to play for Real, shocked his former club with a goal in the 57th minute to secure a one-all draw. The result sends Juventus into next month's final on a 3-2 aggregate. Portuguese star Cristiano Ronaldo, the reigning FIFA World Player of the Year, put Real up with a 23rd-minute penalty shot before Morata silenced the home fans in Madrid when he rifled a shot into the roof of the net. With that penalty shot, Ronaldo is now level with Barcelona's Lionel Messi with 10 goals each at the top of the 2014-2015 UEFA Champions League scoring charts. Ronaldo is also the first player to score at least 10 goals in four different Champions League campaigns. Ronaldo and Messi also jointly hold the all-time goals record for the competition with 77. Joining us now with more sports news is our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma.
We begin with football. Egyptian defending champions El Ahly host Tunisia's Club Africains in Cairo as the quest to advance to the mini-league phase in the Orange Africa Confederations Cup starts tomorrow Friday. Republic of Congo's AC Leopards play Nigeria's Wari Wolves. Guinea's AS Kaloum face South Africa's Orlando Pirates as Democratic Republic of Congo's Sanga Balende engage Egypt's Zamalek. On Saturday, Morocco's Raja Casablanca play Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel. Mali's Stade Malien face Democratic Republic of Congo's AS Vita. Tunisia's CS Faxian challenge Ivory Coast's ASEC Mimosa as Tunisia's Esperance engage Ghana's Heart of Oaks on Sunday. Elsewhere, Lesotho welcomes South Africa to Maseru today, Thursday. A second encounter is scheduled for Saturday. In athletics, Botswana's Olympic 800-meter silver medalist Nigel Amos has an ambitious target. He is gearing up to face the best in the world after sprinting a modest 46.38 seconds in 400 meters at the recent South Africa Open Track and Field Championships in Clokwe.
I always open my season with 400 meters just to check on my speed. I know if I can run 46-400 meters, I'm ready to go 143, 144 in 800.
You're certainly within that bracket in today's final. Going forward, what are we now going to see from you in 800 meters?
The thing about the body feeling and confidence now, I think I'm ready to run 143, 144. I'm looking forward to my first race on 31 May, Diamond League in Prefontaine, USA.
We heard that you had some slight injury about a month ago. Are you fully recovered? How is that situation with your quad?
I can't say I'm fully recovered because I'm still using tapes like now. But I think I'm like 95% healthy better now. I ran 400 without pain, so that's a good start.
So going forward this season, any targets in terms of your time?
Yeah, actually this season I just want to run for winning world champs and chance will just come. Next year is the one I'll be like really want to chase the world record. Next year I will not care about medals or anything. I'll be chasing a world record.
That was Nigel Amos, Botswana's Olympic 800-meter silver medalist. Africa Women's 400-meter hurdles champion Wenda Nell of South Africa aims high at the World Athletics Championships in Beijing, China in August, following her triumph in 54.90 seconds at the recent South Africa Open Track and Field Championships. She is also excited having run a lifetime best of 52.09 seconds in 400 meters flat.
It was very nice. I was excited. I went out quite hard. The aim was to try and run a PB, if not maybe sub 52, but fortunately and unfortunately, I ran 52.09, which I'm still very happy about. We had a slight wind in the back straight, so with all the circumstances taken into account, I'm really, really happy for my time.
Yeah, it was a personal best. What was your previous best?
It was 52.43. Last year I ran 52.53, yeah. I ran the 0.43 earlier this season at Tux.
So going forward, what are your general projections this year?
I especially use this weekend in preparation for the World Championships. We also have heats and semifinals and finals, the different rounds, but not too much race in between. And I think I've conquered what I wanted to. Two hard races within 2 days. I'm really, really happy. I ran season's best with my hurdles today, so very excited for the season ahead.
That was South Africa's Wenda Nell, the Africa Women's 400-meter hurdles champion, speaking in Clokwe, Northwest Province in South Africa. Mark Oma in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Thanks, Mark. Finally, the recent fight between Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao smashed pay-per-view records here in the United States. Cable TV networks HBO and Showtime, which broadcast Mayweather's victory, say there were 4.4 million buys and more than $410 million in revenue. The previous buy record was 2.48 million for Mayweather's 2007 victory over Oscar De La Hoya. When the final count is made, Mayweather-Pacquiao should be around $500 million, the highest grossing fight in history. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Wow, lots of money there.
Big money.
Yes. Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, a proposed solution to South Sudan's deteriorating economy comes from a think tank analyst, and a U.S. Foundation works to strengthen agriculture, technology, water, and health systems in Africa. First, an oldie but goodie, Brenda Fassi with Mingi Mingi. The late Brenda Fossey with Mingi Mingi. Well, as South Sudan's 17-month-old conflict continues, many are wondering how to save the country's deteriorating economy. One co-author of a new paper from a local think tank believes that South Sudan must use its oil revenues more effectively and come up with new strategies for raising revenue. Mugambi Davis Rakaringi has more from Juba.
James Alich Garang, a senior economic analyst with the Ebony Center for Strategic Studies, says one thing is clear. South Sudan's current economic crisis has occurred primarily because of the government's heavy dependence on oil revenue. But since the price of oil has dropped dramatically and South Sudan is producing less of it due to the ongoing conflict, the country's economy is collapsing. In a policy paper published by the Overseas Development Institute, Garang says South Sudan's insecurity has worsened an already precarious situation, and now the Kiir administration is looking at taking on high-risk loans.
When the government could not raise revenue, it thought about taking loan, in essence exceeding the ceiling from the central bank. And when you do that, you increase money supply. That is in essence like printing money. And when you increase money supply, you put pressure on prices. And today we are seeing that in the market.
On top of the poor economy, the destruction of the country's oil infrastructure during the conflict and the inability to rebuild those facilities does not help matters. Now, South Sudan does not have the money for government salaries, state transfers, or investments in social service delivery. All of these conditions contribute to the weakening of the South Sudan pound against the US dollar. Information Minister Michael Makwey says the government must spend money on the military.
In a war situation like this, what do you expect the government to do? Should the government just keep fold its hands and wait for the rebels to take over? Is it supposed to arm the army so that it can protect the nation?
Military expenditures have skyrocketed since the conflict began. According to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, arms purchases have doubled in the past 5 years to $1.08, the highest in East Africa. That amount equals 40% of South Sudan's national budget. Garang says the government's priority must be to raise revenue to counter the falling South Sudan pound. But he says that is not happening.
Some of these dollars don't find their way to the right consumer or to the right demander. They end up under the table and then they found themselves in the street.
The US dollar sells at around 10 pounds on the black market as opposed to the official rate of 3.1. Garang believes one of the solutions is investing in agriculture and other non-oil revenue sources such as timber and fishing.
Take, for example, the teak and the mogon in Western Equatorial. It is illegally mined in small scale and sold by poachers, some of it. But if the government could invest in that, that could be something that we can export.
Garang says the most important thing the government should do to turn around the economy is immediately end the conflict with the rebels. It remains to be seen if the government will heed Garang's advice. The cabinet recently approved spending an estimated $10 million for upcoming Independence Day anniversary celebrations. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinj in Juba.
Africa's economies are facing multiple challenges, including a potential slowdown from the effects of climate change. They also face a growing number of young people needing employment. The U.S.-based Rockefeller Foundation has several projects aimed at boosting development. Its president, Judith Roden, says the foundation is working to strengthen agriculture, water and health systems, and the technology sector. Ruben Kayama reports from Nairobi.
The Rockefeller Foundation president said $100 million was being channeled through an initiative called Digital Jobs Africa in 6 countries, Ghana, Kenya, South Africa, Nigeria, Morocco, and Egypt.
We are excited to see so much opportunity and such a growth market in ICT more broadly across the continent, certainly with broadband coming to the east and so many technology parks growing, so many companies really growing on technology-based platforms. We know that the youth bulge predicted for Africa means that we have to focus, the continent has to focus on employing this extraordinary youth bulge that we're going to see. And so developing growth and developing growth in the ICT sector, which often yields some of the better paying jobs.
Africa's health and prosperity does not only depend on high technology. Rodin says the continent is also experiencing unprecedented shocks and stresses as a result of climate change, from drought to flooding. Millions of lives are at risk.
Well, we've seen challenges because of our work in Africa and South and Southeast Asia. Certainly climate shocks, increasing drought and heat and flooding, either too much rain or too little rain, all across the African continent in each growing season. So the impact on agriculture is significant, certainly the impact on livelihoods significant.
She said the Rockefeller Foundation is working to help small farmers deal with the effects of climate change. It's collaborating with partners to improve water management so runoff from flooding can be used to irrigate fields. In partnership with the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, the foundation is helping to develop drought-resistant seeds. Also, together with the World Food Program, they have developed a technology called Risk Metrics to help predict an impending drought.
We then created, and the African Union is now running this, a country-level insurance mechanisms where the country can buy insurance against the next vulnerability, climate-related vulnerability. And what that does is allow them to get access to resources immediately rather than waiting for development aid once the crisis has occurred, as well as preparing for it more effectively because they have an earlier warning system in the process. And that insurance-like mechanism is one piece of the solution.
Rodin sees potential in African agriculture. She was inspired after visiting a group of mango farmers in Kenya who have teamed up to find new markets for their crops.
The message to the smallholder is think like a business person. Think about all of the ways that you can use your crops. Think about what joining with your neighbor might do in terms of increasing your productivity and your ability to gain more access to bigger markets that would allow you to get more for your product.
The Rockefeller Foundation is also helping African governments deal with another issue occasioned by climate change, the spread of disease.
We know because of climate change that more infectious disease has been skipping from animals to humans, many, many varieties over the last 30 years when we didn't believe that was possible before. So as we see these changes, we've got to prepare both health workers but also health systems to develop the capacity for early warning, early monitoring, and more effective responding.
Rodin says these and other projects include critical market-based solutions that should help Africa continue to develop. She encouraged governments to refine their policies to help guarantee their success. Reporting for VOA News, this is Ruben Chama in Nairobi.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer Bill Workinger and our engineer Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Leaders in Africa and beyond have been sorely tested by an Ebola epidemic that raged through areas in West Africa over the last year and claimed more than 10,600 lives. Thanks to an unprecedented international response, the number of new infections has fallen dramatically. But the crisis isn't over. There's still much to do to bring the epidemic to an end, and even more work is needed to prevent a new outbreak. The United States has helped greatly in combating the epidemic since it was identified a year ago. In September, President Obama brought new urgency to the response with speeches and outreach at the United Nations and set an example for the international community with an expanded U.S. response by deploying U.S. troops to build treatment centers and help train health workers. The African Union has been a major partner in this endeavor. Medical personnel deployed by the AU have been critical to the response. Now, an agreement between the AU and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, will establish an African Center for Disease Control and Prevention. We will work together to improve all of Africa's capacity to prevent, detect, and respond to infectious disease threats. The new center's aim is to strengthen the capacities of African nations to understand disease threats, share information about them, and combat not only Ebola, but also HIV, tuberculosis, malaria, and other diseases. Operations are expected to begin later this year with the opening of a surveillance and response unit that will provide technical expertise to African health ministries and help coordinate response to health emergencies. The U.S. CDC will send two public health experts to the new African CDC to serve as technical advisors. We will also support fellowships for 10 African epidemiologists to help staff 5 regional African CDC coordinating centers that will help monitor infectious disease on the continent. We have greatly slowed Ebola's spread, and if the response is sustained, we expect to end the epidemic in a matter of months. Lessons learned here will help African nations prevent future outbreaks and deal with other diseases, too. But the U.S. needs to continue its involvement as well.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.